Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Mannion. I have stories for you from the October 2006 issue of the good old days magazine. We're going to hear some Halloween stories today. My first trick-or-treat. It's written by Arlene Chauval. The practice of trick-or-treating has been around for a long time. Supposedly, it originated in medieval England when people dressed in black on All Souls' Day, November the 2nd, and walked through the streets begging for offerings for the dead. They were called soulers, and they received treats from living relatives in return for prayers for the deceased. The trick part came from the Irish, who believed the little people, leprechauns and such, were responsible for Halloween pranks. Later, the English dressed in costumes of their favorite saints on October the 31st, All Saints' Day, and marched through the streets singing and visiting the churches. Some dressed as angels or devils, and soon many costumes came into being. But my family in Iron River, Michigan, didn't learn about trick-or-treat until Halloween in about 1945. My grandmother had arranged a Halloween party for me, my little brother, some cousins, and the neighborhood kids. My grandma was Irish. In fact, her sons gave her the nickname Irish, so she was really into Halloween ghost stories and such things. She always saw it to it that we kids had a great time on Halloween. I was 5 years old that year. We kids were gathered in the kitchen for the party. My dad helped me carve a big pumpkin, and soon the soft glow of the grinning jack-o'-lantern filled the kitchen as Grandma busied herself making her special friend cakes, cake donuts fried in deep fat. We kids were helping roll the hot donuts in sugar when the knock came at the door. Naturally, we were frightened. So were our mothers. After all, who could be out and about on a dark, cold Halloween night? My mother went to the door, and I followed close behind, curious about whom this midnight visitor might be. It was a long way from midnight, of course, but imaginations get away from you on Halloween. Outside, under the porch light, stood a group of neighborhood boys in costume. Someone was carrying a blue light, perhaps a flashlight. Another had one of those old-fashioned Halloween noisemakers that were popular back then, and he spun it around, making a buzzing noise. The boys were saying, "Trick or treat," but my mother didn't know what they wanted. It was the first time anyone had come to our door on Halloween asking for treats. She called Grandma and the other women to the door to admire the costumes and pretend to be afraid. The women thanked the boys for stopping by to show us your costumes. Then they shut the door, and we all went back to our party. The boys went on their way, certainly disappointed at the lack of treats from our house. But we didn't know any better. We were probably lucky that we didn't have our windows soaked that night. A week or two later, my mother was telling a friend about the boys coming to the house on Halloween. That was when she learned about trick or treat. She was embarrassed. She would have at least shared some of Grandma's homemade donuts with the group had she known they were looking for treats. The next year, Grandma and my mother were prepared. Mother made homemade popcorn balls, and Grandma made balls of puffed rice and puffed wheat cereal using the same syrup my mother used for the popcorn balls. I helped wrap the balls in wax paper. By Halloween 1946, it seemed that everyone knew about trick-or-treat, and several groups of costumed neighborhood children were making the rounds. The popcorn balls and cereal balls were a hit as the kids eagerly held out their pillowcases and paper sacks to receive the treats. By 1947, my little brother, my friend, and I had joined the ranks of trick-or-treaters. We were making plans for our costumes and our trick-or-treat route by the end of July. Halloween always had been my favorite time of year, and trick-or-treating just added to the fun with the excitement of going out after dark. But my mother has never forgotten her embarrassment about not knowing about trick-or-treat that first year. It was a Halloween I'll always remember. My first trick-or-treat was written by Arlene Chabald. Let's turn to Outhouse Prank. This is written by Joseph L. Thurer. When I was about 5 years old, we moved to a farm. I was the youngest of six children, and I had three older brothers and two older sisters. My sister Helen was the eldest of the six. Next came my oldest brother, Bernard. Bernard was 13 years older than I was, and he always had a prank to pull. On one warm late October day, Bernard seemed to spend an excessive amount of time in the outhouse. He said he was fixing a loose board. That evening, my parents had a masquerade party with lots of aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends. After the party started, we saw Bernard sneaking out. My brother Daniel, 2 years my senior, and I followed Bernard at a discreet distance. It wasn't far to the outhouse. We watched as one of our aunts entered the outhouse. But after 10 or 15 seconds, she came out screaming. We did not know what had happened. Soon, another aunt visited the outhouse. Daniel and I crept closer to Bernard, who was behind a wood pile. He had removed one log so that he could observe the outhouse without being seen. We saw that he had a pipe running from the wood pile into the back of the outhouse under the seat. This time we were close enough to hear Bernard when, after 10 or 15 seconds, he said through the pipe, "Would you please move over? I am trying to paint down here while there is still some light." Another aunt went screaming. By this time, Mother got wind of what was going on. She knew that Bernard was behind it all, and soon she put a stop to his prank. Outhouse Prank was written by Joseph L. Thurer. Turning now, in the October 2006 issue of The Good Old Days magazine, to Halloween Parties. It's written by Eileen Knockenhauer. The barn of my childhood pops into my mind every once in a while. Most recently, I was thinking about the Halloween parties my parents had for me in the barn. In the 1950s, on Long Island, New York, specifically West Islip, the countryside was still somewhat rural, but change was in the air. You could sense it coming, and you felt tingly anticipation as well as secret apprehension. It was kind of like a storm that was still far away. For the moment you were safe, but soon the storm would be in your backyard. Housing developments were cropping up on our former potato fields, and they would forever change the pastoral landscape of Long Island. However, a few barns still nestled comfortably amid corn stalks, pumpkin patches, and open land dotted with fruit trees, and we were lucky enough to have a barn in our backyard. The red barn was capped with a black shingled roof. It rested at the end of a long, winding driveway. Its stature belied its 40-some-odd years. It had two sliding doors, but I remember only one working. On the east side, there was a black metal ring where a horse was once tethered. It had a loft on top with a door to the outside where we would hoist up things to be stored before my dad built a ladder-type stairway on the inside wall. In one sense, the barn had outlived its original purpose. However, it was the essence of the land our family called home. After a while, My dad built an adjoining dog pen on the west side of the barn for Smokey, our black and white mixed breed dog. Then he built a hen house for our Rhode Island Reds on the east side. A small corn patch was planted in front of the hen house, creating a bucolic landscape where we collected creamy-tasting brown eggs and picked fresh corn. However, our slice of God's green acre was in an area quickly yielding to the developers' bulldozers. On the upside, though, the new homes which soon skirted our property brought lifelong friends for me and broadened my perspective of the world. It is my memories of these good old days in West Islip that I would like to share. It is my opinion that each place is unique in its own right, as each person's story is unique to him. This one is mine. A few days before Halloween, my mother would get it into her head that we were having a Halloween party. No invitations were sent out, no food was catered in, and no fuss was made over the party. I simply invited the kids who lived in the development around our house to come over after school, and that was that. The day before the party, my mother would walk with my sister Pat, my friend Sheila, and me to a nursery about a half a mile away. Behind the florist was a field full of corn stalks and gourds available to anyone just for the picking. Thinking back, we were probably the only ones who would walk over frozen ruts in the mud just to collect corn stalks. We filled our arms with the corn stalks, some a little muddy, and many with corn still attached, and staggered home. We then arranged them in the barn to hide my dad's workbench and the old refrigerator that my mother had painted bright turquoise because that was the only paint she had available when she got it into her head to paint it. The stalks also concealed a Norman Rockwell print of Mrs. O'Leary's cow being milked by her in a barn. O'Leary was our last name. My dad got a big kick out of this coincidence, even though, to the best of our knowledge, there was no family connection. We didn't know one single person in Chicago. In spite of the fact that the painting might bring to mind the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, my dad seemed to find a perverse pleasure in owning a picture of the O'Leary cow. My mother, on the other hand, thought that emphasizing the rear end of a cow was vulgar and would only permit it to be hung in the barn next to Dad's workbench, never in the house. Sometime over the years, the picture just disappeared. Anyway, the corn stalks created an outdoorsy feeling in the barn. They were stuffed between the rungs on the ladder to the loft and between the rakes and shovels leaning against the walls. There wasn't much light in the barn except for a bare bulb over the workbench. It was pretty eerie at night. Dad had some hawk claws nailed up there, and they definitely added to the spookiness. Before the party, my mother fastened some string to a nail hanging from a ceiling beam. At the bottom of the string, she secured an apple. She then inserted coins, mainly dimes, all around the apple. Next, she filled an old copper boiler with water and threw some apples in there. She made popcorn and cinnamon donuts and wonderful pumpkin pie. It contained so many spices that it was brown, not orange, and the best I've ever eaten. Her trick was molasses, and I still use it in my pumpkin pie to this day. When it got dark, after the trick-or-treating, the kids came to the party. It was always cold in October back then, but I don't remember anyone complaining. We were all wearing a costume over our clothes, so we were pretty warm. The costumes, like everything else, were homemade. You could not find a store that sold costumes if you tried. The costumes all had a Halloween theme. Witch, skeleton, ghost, or the easy-to-make bum costume. I do remember, however, being a beatnik one year, whatever that means. We drank cold cider and feasted on the donuts and pumpkin pie. My mother gave out waxed paper sandwich bags, greasy with melted butter and overflowing with homemade popcorn to kids at the party, as well as any trick-or-treaters who showed up. No one ever questioned if it was safe to eat. Sometimes my mother made a fire and threw in some potatoes to roast. She called them Mickeys, and they always were blackened to perfection. We added butter and salt, and it was a meal. After eating, the games began. A few kids bent over the boiler and dunked for apples. A line formed around the hanging apple that was swinging on the string. The person whose turn it was placed her hands behind her back and tried to stop the apple from moving and remove a coin with her teeth. This took plenty of time and evoked tons of laughter. The kids were an assorted bunch, mostly girls, but a few boys who lived in the neighborhood came as well. Their ages varied from the very young, 7 years old, up to 14 or 15 years old. People had big families, and brothers and sisters often tagged along. When the food was eaten and the games played, everyone started home. Most kids were wet from the apple dunking, but no one cared. They wandered from the dim light of the barn into the misty night. Sometimes a frosty moon shone through the bare branches and lit the path for the chilly walk home on Halloween night. No parents were waiting in cars to pick up anyone. It was unheard of. Besides, it would have spoiled the nervous, scary feelings everyone had as they made their way home in the dark, fearing the sounds of the night. Some of us considered ourselves lucky. We went to St. Joseph's School, which meant that we had no school the day after Halloween, November the 1st, All Saints Day. How great was that? The barn, now close to 100 years old, still stands. Kids still come to the house to trick-or-treat. My sister, Pat, gives out candy now. People no longer trust homemade popcorn. But those kids who grew up in West Islip in the 1950s still remember my mom's popcorn and all the fun we had on Halloween in the barn. Halloween Parties was written by Eileen Knockenhauer. And we're turning now to Halloween Memories. This is written by Connie Morrow. Whatever happened to Halloween as I knew it growing up in the 1950s? Ah, yes, my dad would rake leaves into big piles that we would promptly jump into, scattering them everywhere. Then he would do something unheard of today. He would burn the leaves. I still remember that wonderful smell in the frosty air. Little sparks and embers from the leaves would fly high into the sky. Outdoor playtime was limited to the time before dinner as the days grew shorter. After homework was done, we either watched television, 3 stations then and no remote, or read comic books. My favorites were Archie, Sugar and Spike, the precursor to Rugrats, and Little Lulu. I ate hard, sour, fresh-picked apples while I immersed myself in the antics of my comic book friends. My mom would decorate the house with all kinds of scary Halloween decorations. There were black cats, smiling jack-o'-lanterns, and flying bats. The week before the big day, our parents took us out to pick out our pumpkin. Sometimes we got more than one of the huge orange gourds. Mom and Dad would carve it and let us think we were helping. The truth was, we weren't allowed to play with knives. After the pumpkin was carved, we would put the seeds on a cookie sheet with a little oil and salt and let them roast very slowly in the oven. This was a special treat reserved for the days leading up to Halloween. Our pumpkin always had a real candle inside. Sometimes we had to cut an extra hole in the back so the candle would stay lit. To this day, the smell of a burning pumpkin lid sometimes brings back memories of my childhood. Weeks of planning went into our Halloween costumes. The costumes at the store were usually divided into two price ranges, the cheaper being characters such as ghosts or witches. The most expensive costume was the bridal dress. Oh, how I wanted that costume. It was white lace and so pretty. I still remember the name on the boxes, Ben Cooper, but I usually ended up being a ghost, witch, or gypsy. The costume for a gypsy was quite simple. You needed a long flowing skirt, a bandana to wear around the head, a peasant blouse, and of course, big hoop earrings. My mother had the best gypsy earrings in the world. They were silver, and they screwed on. Those screws really hurt my ears, but they looked so cool. The smell of the makeup that we used is still etched in my brain, too. Every time one of the kids gets that kind of makeup today, the smell fills my head with vivid memories. I believe that it was Ben Nye makeup, and they still make it today. The masks that came with the costumes were great, but I had allergies and sinus problems as a child, and my nose would run the whole time I had it on. It got kind of soggy with that mask on my face. People in our neighborhood were very generous with their treats. Back in the 1950s, we weren't afraid to go into someone's house and have cider and donuts. One family even gave us homemade popcorn balls. The treats were amazing. Candy, apples, potato chips, even money. We were treated very well. And the treating wasn't just one night. It was three. We had Beggar's Night on October the 30th, Halloween on the 31st, and what the kids called Garbage Night on the 1st of November. There was no need to x-ray our candy. We could eat it as we walked down the street to the next house. Until I reached the ripe old age of 10, Mom or Dad would go out with us. When Dad took us, he would drive the car to each house and watch us as we made our way through the neighborhood. It seemed like everybody was out on the streets those nights. Being in western New York State, we were never sure what kind of weather would greet us on Halloween night. Some years it was Indian summer. Other years we had to wear our snow suits under our costumes. Our school also celebrated Halloween. At class parties, we were served cookies made by the moms and that old standby, Hawaiian punch. We were allowed to wear our costumes to school on the day of the party. It seemed like everyone on the school bus had a costume except the bus driver. Some years I had a party on one of the nights of Halloween. Once we decorated our hallway as a haunted house. There was a bowl of grapes that we called eyeballs, and another bowl of cooked spaghetti that served as brains. Strings hung from the ceiling served as makeshift cobwebs. My friends loved it. I wish that the kids of today could have some of the fun we had. Things were simpler and a little safer. I have all these wonderful memories, so at least I can tell the younger generation about Halloween in the good old days. Halloween Memories was written by Connie Morrow. And now let's listen to The Ghost in the Attic. It's by Francis Calmet Dorr. So many people write about the treasures they find in their attics. Ours was different. Our two uncles, who boarded with us, slept in our attic. They had no heat in winter and no fan in summer. It was very uncomfortable, to say the least. However, that is not my story. When we were children, our parents made us behave by telling us that the ghost in the attic would get us. We never believed in the ghost, but it still made us uneasy. When I was about 7 years old, I was in the living room playing by ear on the piano. I looked out into the hall and saw the attic door slowly opening. I was sure it was the ghost, so I ran out and slammed the door as hard as I could. The ghost was my Uncle John, whom I didn't know was at home. I thought I was home alone. Luckily, he wasn't hurt. I dearly loved him and felt so awful. Once before, my sister, Mary, had locked the attic door when our Uncle Joe was up there. We heard him banging on the door and rescued him. It is nice that people find treasures in their attics, but we had two treasures in ours, Uncle Joe and Uncle John. Their love and kindness in the good old days will always be remembered. The Ghost in the Attic was written by Francis Calmet Dorr. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Robin Clemens.